Chapter 8. There would be no deep breathing tonight. The window would remain closed above the frozen and empty quad, beyond which the windows in the opposite wall were, with two or three exceptions, already dark. Soon the chimes would ring for midnight, the notes melodious and tranquil, faint and clear as glass in the fierce, it had quit snowing, still air. "So the old man sent the nigger for Henry," Shreve said. "And Henry came in, and the old man said, 'They cannot marry because he is your brother.' And Henry said, 'You lie,' like that, that quick. No space, no interval, no nothing between, like when you press the button and get light in the room. And the old man just sat there, didn't even move and strike him, and so Henry didn't say, 'You lie,' again, because he knew now it was so. He just said, 'It's not true, not I don't believe it, but it's not true,' because he could maybe see the old man's face again now, and demon or no, it was a kind of grief and pity, not for himself, but for Henry, because Henry was just young while he, the old man, knew that he still had the courage and even all the shrewdness, too." Shreve stood beside the table, facing Quentin again, though not seated now. In the overcoat buttoned awry over the bathrobe, he looked huge and shapeless, like a disheveled bear as he stared at Quentin. The southerner, whose blood ran quick to cool, more supple to compensate for violent changes of temperature, perhaps merely nearer the surface, who sat hunched in his chair, his hands thrust into his pockets as if he were trying to hug himself warm between his arms, looking somehow fragile and even wan in the lamplight, the rosy glow which now had nothing of warmth, coziness in it, while both their breathing vaporized faintly in the cold room where there was now not two of them but four. The two who breathed, not individuals now, yet something both more and less than twins, the heart and blood of youth. Shreve was 19, a few months younger than Quentin. He looked exactly 19. He was one of those people whose correct age you never know because they look exactly that, and so you tell yourself that he or she cannot possibly be that, because he or she looks too exactly that not to take advantage of the appearance. So you never believe implicitly that he or she is either that age which they claim, or that which in sheer desperation they agree to, or which someone else reports them to be. Strong enough and willing enough for two, for 2,000, for all. Not two of them in a New England college sitting room, but one in a Mississippi library 60 years ago, with holly and mistletoe in vases on the mantel or thrust behind, crowning and garlanding with the season and time the pictures on the walls, and a sprig or so decorating the photograph, the group, mother and two children, on the desk behind which the father sat when the son entered. And they, Quentin and Shreve, thinking how after the father spoke and before what he said stopped being shock and began to make sense, the son would recall later how he had seen through the window beyond his father's head the sister and the lover in the garden, pacing slowly, the sister's head bent with listening, the lover's head leaned above it while they paced slowly on in that rhythm which not the eyes but the heart marks and calls the beat and measure for, to disappear slowly beyond some bush or shrub starred with white bloom. Jasmine, spirea, honeysuckle, perhaps myriad scentless unpickable Cherokee roses. Names, blooms, which Shreve possibly had never heard and never seen, although the air had blown over him first, which became tempered to nourish them. And it would not matter here that the time had been winter in that garden, too, and hence no bloom nor leaf, even if there had been someone to walk there and be seen there, since, judged by subsequent events, it had been night in the garden also. But that did not matter because it had been so long ago. It did not matter to them, Quentin and Shreve, anyway, who could, without moving, as free now of flesh as the father who decreed and forbade, the son who denied and repudiated, the lover who acquiesced, the beloved who was not bereaved, and with no tedious transition from hearth and garden, granted the garden, to saddle, be already clattering over the frozen ruts of that December night and that Christmas dawn, that day of peace and cheer, of holly and goodwill and logs on the hearth. Not two of them there and then either, but four of them riding the two horses through the iron darkness, and that not mattering either, what faces and what names they called themselves and were called by so long as the blood coursed. The blood, the immortal, brief, recent, intransient blood which could hold honor above slothy unregret and love above fat and easy shame. "And Bond didn't know it," Shreve said. The old man didn't move, and this time Henry didn't say, "You lie." He said, "It's not true." And the old man said, "Ask him, ask Charles then." And then Henry knew that that was what his father had meant all the time, and that that was what he meant himself when he told his father he lied. Because what the old man said wasn't just, "He is your brother," but, "He has known all the time that he is yours and your sister's brother." But Bond didn't. "Listen, don't you remember how your father said it? About how not one time did he, the old guy, the demon, ever seem to wonder either how the other wife managed to find him, track him down? It never once seemed to wonder what she might have been doing all that time? How she might have passed that time? The 30 years since that day when he paid his bill with her and got it receipted, so he thought, and saw with his own eyes that it was, so he thought, destroyed, torn up, and thrown to the wind? Never once wondered about this, but only that she had done it, had tracked him down, could have and would have wanted to. So it wasn't her that told Bond. She wouldn't have, maybe for the reason that she knew he, the demon, would believe she had. Or maybe she didn't get around to telling him. Maybe she just never thought that there could be anyone as close to her as a lone child out of her own body who would have to be told how she had been scorned and suffered. Or maybe she was already telling it before he was big enough to know words, and so by the time he was big enough to understand what was being told him, she had told it so much and so hard that the words didn't make sense to her anymore either, because they didn't have to make sense to her. And so she had got to the point where when she thought she was saying it, she was quiet. And when she thought she was quiet, it was just the hate and the fury and the unsleeping and the unforgetting. Or maybe she didn't intend for him to know it then. Maybe she was grooming him for that hour and moment which she couldn't foresee, but that she knew would arrive some day because it would have to arrive, or else she would have to do like the Aunt Rosa and deny that she had ever breathed. The moment when he would stand side by side, not face to face, with his father, where fate or luck or justice or whatever she called it could do the rest. And it did, better than she could have invented or hoped or even dreamed. And your father said how, being a woman, she probably wasn't even surprised. Grooming him herself, bringing him on by hand herself, washing and feeding and putting him to bed and giving him the candy and the toys and the other child's fun and diversion and needs in measured doses like medicine with her own hand. Not because she had to, who could have hired a dozen or bought 100 to do it for her with the money, the jack that he, the demon, had voluntarily surrendered, repudiated to balance his moral ledger. But like the millionaire who could have had 100 hostlers and handlers, but who has just the one horse, the one maiden, the one moment, the one matching of heart and muscle and will with the one instant. And himself, the millionaire, patient in the overalls and the sweat and the stable muck. Bringing him along to the moment when she would say, "He is your father. He cast you and me aside and denied you his name. Now go." And then sit down and let God finish it, pistol or knife or rack, destruction or grief or anguish. God to call the shot or turn the wheel. Jesus, you can almost see him. A little boy already come to learn, to expect, before he could remember having learned his own name or the name of the town where he lived or how to say either of them, that every so often he would be snatched up from playing and held, gripped between the two hands, fierce with, what passed at least with him for it, love, against the two fierce rigid knees, the face that he remembered since before remembering began as supervising all the animal joys of palate and stomach and entrails, of warmth and pleasure and security, swooping down at him in a kind of blazing immobility. He taking the interruption as a matter of course, as just another natural phenomenon of existence. The face filled with furious and almost unbearable unforgiving, almost like fever, not bitterness and despair, just implacable will for revenge, as just another manifestation of mammalian love. And he not knowing what in hell it was all about, who would be too young to curry any connected fact out of the fury and hate and the tumbling speed, not comprehending or caring, just curious, creating for himself, without help, since who to help him, his own notion of that Puerto Rico or Haiti or wherever it was he understood vaguely that he had come from, like Orthodox children do of heaven or the Cabbage Patch or wherever it was that they came from. Except that his was different in that you were not supposed, your mother didn't intend to anyway, to ever go back there. And maybe when you got as old as she was, you would be horrified too every time you found hidden in your thoughts anything that just smelled or tasted like it might be a wish to go back there. which you were not supposed to know when and why you left, but only that you had escaped, that whatever power had created the place for you to hate it had likewise got you away from the place, so you could hate it good and never forgive it in quiet and monotony, though not exactly in what you would call peace. That you were to thank God you didn't remember anything about it, yet at the same time you were not to, maybe dared not to, ever forget it. He not even knowing maybe that he took it for granted that all kids didn't have fathers too, and that getting snatched every day or so from whatever harmless pursuit in which you were not bothering anybody or even thinking about them, by someone because that someone was bigger than you, stronger than you, and being held for a minute or 5 minutes under a kind of busted water pipe of incomprehensible fury and fierce yearning and vindictiveness and jealous rage was a part of childhood which all mothers of children had received in turn from their mothers, and from their mothers in turn from that Puerto Rico or Haiti or wherever it was we all came from but none of us ever lived in. So that when he grew up and had children he would have to pass it on too, and maybe deciding then and there that it was too much trouble and bother and that he would not have any children, or at least hoped he would not. And hence no man had a father, no one personal Puerto Rico or Haiti, but all mother faces which ever bred swooping down at those almost calculable moments, out of some obscure ancient general affronting and outraging which the actual living articulate meat had not even suffered, but merely inherited. All boy flesh that walked and breathed, stemming from that one ambiguous, eluded, dark fatherhead, and so brothered, perennial, and ubiquitous everywhere under the sun. They stared at one another, glared, rather, their quiet, regular breathing vaporizing faintly and steadily in the now tomb-like air. There was something curious in the way they looked at one another, curious and quiet and profoundly intent. Not at all as two young men might look at each other, but almost as a youth and a very young girl might, out of virginity itself. A sort of hushed and naked searching, each look burdened with youth's immemorial obsession, not with time's dragging weight which the old live with, but with its fluidity, the bright heels of all the lost moments of 15 and 16. Then he got older and got out from under the apron, despite her. Him too, maybe the both of them, and he didn't even care. He found out that she was up to something, and he not only didn't care, he didn't even care that he didn't know what it was. Got older and found out that she had been shaping and tempering him to be the instrument for whatever it was her hand was implacable for. Maybe came to believe or saw that she had tricked him into receiving that shape and temper, and didn't care about that, too, because probably by that time he had learned that there were three things and no more: breathing, pleasure, darkness. And without money there could be no pleasure, and without pleasure it would not even be breathing, but mere protoplasmic inhale and collapse of blind unorganism in a darkness where light never began. And he had the money because he knew that she knew that the money was the only thing she could coerce and smooth him into the barrier with when Derby Day came, so she didn't dare pinch him there, and she knew he knew it. So that maybe he even blackmailed her, bought her off that way. You give me the jack as I want it, and I won't ask why or what for yet. Or maybe she was so busy grooming him that she never thought of the money now, who probably never had had much time to remember it or count it or wonder how much there was in the intervals of the hating and the being mad, and so all to check him up about the money would be the lawyer, and he, Bon, probably learned that the first thing, that he could go to his mother and hold the lawyer's feet to the fire any time, like the millionaire horse has only to come in one time with a little extra sweat on him, and tomorrow he will have a new jock. Sure, that's who it would be, the lawyer, that lawyer with his private mad female millionaire to farm, who probably wasn't interested enough in the money to see whether the checks had any other writing on them when she signed them. That lawyer who, with Bond's mother already plotting and planning him since before he could remember, and even if she didn't know it, or whether she knew it or not, or would have cared or not, for that day when he should be translated quick into so much rich and rotting dirt, had already been plowing and planting and harvesting him and the mother both as if he already was. That lawyer who maybe had the secret drawer in the secret safe and the secret paper in it, maybe a chart with colored pins stuck into it like generals have in campaigns, and all the notations in code. Today he finished robbing a drunken Indian of 100 miles of virgin land, value 25,000.
This book is continued. on Disc 9.
Today he finished robbing a drunken Indian of 100 miles of virgin land, value 25,000. At 2:31 today came up out of swamp with final plank for house, value in conjunction with land 40,000. 7:52 p.m. today married. Bigamy threat value minus nil unless quick buyer. Not probable. Doubtless conjoined with wife same day. Say 1 year. And then with maybe the date and the hour, too. Son, intrinsic value possible, though not probably forced sale of house and land plus value crop minus child's 1/4. Emotional value plus 100 times nil plus value crop. Say 10 years, 1 or more children. Intrinsic value forced sale house and improved land plus liquid assets minus children's share. Emotional value 100% times increase yearly for each child plus intrinsic value plus liquid assets plus working acquired credit. And maybe here with the date too. Daughter. And you could maybe even have seen the question mark after it and the other words even. Daughter. 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 Trailing off not because thinking trailed off, but on the contrary, thinking stopping right still then. Backing up a little and spreading like when you lay a stick across a trickle of water, spreading and rising slow all around him in whatever place it was that he could lock the door to and sit quiet and subtract the money that Bon was spending on his whores and his champagne from what his mother had, and figure up how much would be left of it tomorrow and next month and next year, or until suppin' would be good and ripe. Thinking about the good hard cash that Bon was throwing away on his horses and clothes, and the champagne and gambling and women. He would have known about the octoroon and the left-handed marriage long before the mother did, even if it had been any secret. Maybe he even had a spy in the bedroom like he seems to have had in Sutphen's. Maybe he even planted her, said to himself like you do about a dog, he is beginning to ramble. He needs a block, not a tether, just a light block of some sort so he can't get inside of anything that might have a fence around it. And only him to try to check it, or as much as he dared, and not getting far because he knew, too, that all Bon had to do was to go to his mother and the racehorse would have a gold eating trough if he wanted it, and, if the jock wasn't careful, a new jockey, too. Counting up the money, figuring what he would net at this normal rate over the next few years, against what it looked like would be left of it to net from by that time, and meanwhile crucified between his two problems. Whether maybe what he ought to do was to wash his hands of the Sutphen angle and clean up what was left and light out for Texas. Except whenever he thought about doing that, he would have to think about all the money that Bon had already spent, and that if he had only gone to Texas 10 years ago or 5 years ago or even last year. So that maybe at night while he would be waiting for the window to begin to turn gray, he would be like the Aunt Rosa said she was, and he would have to deny that he breathed, or maybe wished he didn't, except for that 200% times the intrinsic value every New Year's. The water backing up from the stick and rising and spreading about him steady and quiet as light, and him sitting there in the actual white glare of clairvoyance, or second sight, or faith in human misfortune and folly, or whatever you want to call it, that was showing him not only what might happen, but what was actually going to happen, and him declining to believe it was going to happen, not because it had come to him as a vision, but because it would have to have love and honor and courage and pride in it, and believing it might happen, not because it was logical and possible, but because it would be the most unfortunate thing for all concerned that could occur. And though you could no more have proved vice or virtue or courage or cowardice to him without showing him the moving people than you could have proved death to him without showing him a corpse, he did believe in misfortune because of that rigorous and arduous dusty eunuch's training which taught to leave man's good luck and joys to God, who would in return surrender all his miseries and follies and misfortunes to the lice and fleas of Coke and Littleton. And the old Sabine... They stared, glared at one another. Their voices, it was Shreve speaking, though save for the slight difference which the intervening degrees of latitude had inculcated in them, differences not in tone or pitch, but in turns of phrase and usage of words. It might have been either of them, and was in a sense both. Both thinking as one, the voice which happened to be speaking the thought, only the thinking become audible, vocal. The two of them creating between them, out of the ragtag and bob-ends of old tales and talking, people who perhaps had never existed at all anywhere, who, shadows, were shadows not of flesh and blood which had lived and died, but shadows in turn of what were, to one of them at least, to Shreve, shades too, quiet as the visible murmur of their vaporizing breath. The chimes now began to ring for midnight, melodious, slow and faint beyond the closed, the snow-sealed window. The old Sabine, who couldn't to save her life have told you or the lawyer or Bonn or anybody else probably what she wanted, expected, hoped for, because she was a woman and didn't need to want or hope or expect anything but just to want and expect and hope. And besides, your father said that when you have plenty of good strong hating you don't need hope because the hating will be enough to nourish you. The old Sabine, not so old yet, but she would have just let herself go in the sense that you keep the engines clean and oiled and the best of coal in the bunkers, but you don't bother to shine the brightwork or holystone the decks anymore. Just let herself go on the outside. Not fat. She would burn it up too fast for that, shrivel it away in the gullet between swallowing and stomach. No pleasure in the chewing, having to chew just another nuisance like no pleasure in the clothing. Having the old wear out and having to choose the new just another nuisance, and no pleasure in the fine figure he, neither of them said Bonn, cut in the fine pants that fit his leg and the fine coats that fit his shoulders, nor in the fact that he had more watches and cuff buttons and finer linen and horses and yellow-wheeled buggies, not to mention the gals, than most others did, but all that too just an unavoidable nuisance that he would have had to get shut of before he could do her any good. Just like he had to get shut of the teething and the chicken pox and the light boy's bones in order to be able to do her any good. The old Sabine getting the faked reports from the lawyer like reports sent back to headquarters from a battlefront, with maybe a special nigger in the lawyer's anteroom to do nothing else but carry them, and that maybe once in 2 years or 5 times in 2 days, depending on when she would begin to itch for news and began to worry him. The report, the communique about how we are not far behind him in Texas or Missouri or maybe California. California would be fine, that far away, convenient, proof inherent in the sheer distance, the necessity to accept and believe. And we are going to catch up with him any day now, and so do not worry. So she wouldn't. She wouldn't worry at all. She would just have out the carriage and go to the lawyer, busting in the black dress that looked like a section of limp stovepipe, and maybe not even a hat but just a shawl over her head, so that the only things missing would be the mop and the pail, busting in and saying, "He's dead, I know he is dead, and how can he be?" Not meaning what the Aunt Rosa meant. Where did they find or invent a bullet that could kill him? But how can he be allowed to die without having to admit that he was wrong and suffer and regret it? And so in the next 2 seconds they would almost catch him. He, the lawyer, would show her the actual letter, the writing in the English she couldn't read, that had just come in, that he had just sent for the nigger to carry to her when she came in, and the lawyer done practiced putting the necessary date on the letter until he could do it now while his back would be toward her, in the 2 seconds it would take him to get the letter out of the file, catch him, get so close to him as to have ample satisfaction that he was alive, so close indeed that he would be able to get her out of the office before she had sat down and into the carriage again and on the way home again where, among the Florentine mirrors and Paris drapes and tufted camisoles, she would still look like the one that had to come in to scrub the floors, in the black dress that the cook wouldn't have looked at even when it was new 5 or 6 years ago, holding, clutching the letter she couldn't read, maybe the only word in it she could even recognize would be the word Sutpen, in one hand, and brushing back a rope of lank iron-colored hair with the other, and not looking at the letter like she was reading it, even if she could have, but swooping at it, blazing down at it as if she knew she would have only a second to read it in, only a second for it to remain intact in after her eyes would touch it, before it took fire and so would not be perused but consumed, leaving her sitting there with a black crumbling blank carbon ash in her hand. And him? Neither of them, said Bonn. They're watching her, who had got old enough to have learned that what he thought was childhood wasn't childhood, that other children had been made by fathers and mothers where he had been created new when he began to remember, new again when he came to the point where his carcass quit being a baby and became a boy, new again when he quit being a boy and became a man, between a woman whom he had thought was feeding and washing and putting him to bed and finding him in the extra ticklings for his palate and his pleasure because he was himself, until he got big enough to find out that it wasn't him at all she was washing and feeding, the candy and the fun too, but it was a man that hadn't even arrived yet, whom even she had never seen yet, who would be something else beside that boy when he did arrive, like the dynamite which destroys the house and the family and maybe even the whole community, ain't the old peaceful paper that maybe would rather be blowing aimless and light along the wind, or the old merry sawdust, or the old quiet chemicals that had rather be still and dark in the quiet earth like they had been before the meddling guy with 10-power spectacles came and dug them up and strained, warped, and kneaded them. Created between this woman and a hired lawyer, the woman who since before he could remember he now realized had been planning and grooming him for some moment that would come and pass, and following which he saw that to her he would be little more than so much rich rotting dirt. The lawyer, who since before he could remember he now realized had been ploughing and planting and watering and manuring and harvesting him as if he already was. Him watching her, lounging there against the mantel, maybe in the fine clothes, in the harem incense odor of what you might call easy sanctity. Watching her looking at the letter, not even thinking, I am looking upon my mother naked, since if the hating was nakedness, she had worn it long enough now for it to do the office of clothing like they say that modesty can do, does. So he went away. He went away to school at the age of 28. And he wouldn't know nor care about that either. Which of them, mother or lawyer, it was who decided he should go to school, nor why. Because he had known all the time that his mother was up to something and that the lawyer was up to something, and he didn't care enough about what either of them was to try to find out. Who knew that the lawyer knew that his mother was up to something, but that his mother didn't know that the lawyer was up to something, and that it would be all right with the lawyer if his mother got whatever it was she wanted, provided he, the lawyer, got what he wanted 1 second before, or at least at the same time. He went away to school. He said all right, and told the octoroon goodbye, and went to school, who not in all the 28 years had ever been told by anyone, do as these others do, have this task done at 9 a.m. tomorrow or Friday or Monday. Maybe it was even the octoroon whom they, or the lawyer, used. The light block, not tether, which the lawyer had put on him to keep him from getting inside of something which might be found to have a fence around it later. Maybe the mother found out about the octoroon and the child and the ceremony, and discovered more than the lawyer had, or would believe, who considered Bonn only dull, not a fool, and sent for him, and he came and lounged against the mantel again, and maybe knowing what was up, what had happened before she told him, lounging there with an expression on his face you might call smiling, except it was not that, but just something you couldn't see through or past. And she watching him with maybe the lank iron-colored strand of hair down again, and not even bothering to brush it back now because she was not looking at any letter now, but her eyes blazing at him, her voice trying to blaze at him out of the urgency of alarm and fear, but she managing to keep it down since she could not talk about betrayal because she had not told him yet, and now at this moment she would not dare risk it. He looking at her from behind the smiling that wasn't smiling but was just something you were not supposed to see beyond, saying, admitting it, why not? All young men do it. The ceremony too. I didn't set out to get the child, but now that I have, it's not a bad child either. And she watching him, glaring at him and not being able to say what she would because she had put off too long now saying what she could. But you, this is different. And he, she would not need to say it, he would know because he already knew why she had sent for him, even if he did not know and did not care what she had been up to since before he could remember, since before he could take a woman, whether in love or not. Why not? Men seem to have to marry some day, sooner or later, and this is one whom I know, who makes me no trouble. And with the ceremony, that bother already done. And as for a little matter like a spot of Negro blood, not needing to talk much, say much either, not needing to say, I seem to have been born into this world with so few fathers that I have too many brothers to outrage and shame while alive, and hence too many descendants to bequeath my little portion of hurt and harm to, dead. Not that, just a little spot of Negro blood, and then to watch the face, the desperate urgency and fear, then to depart, kissing her maybe, her hand maybe, which would lie in his and even touch his lips like a dead hand because of the desperate casting for this straw or that. Maybe as he went out, he said, she will go to him, the lawyer. If I were to wait 5 minutes, I could see her in the shawl. So probably by tonight I will be able to know, if I cared to know. Maybe by night he did, maybe before that if they managed to find him, get word to him, because she went to the lawyer, and it was right in the lawyer's alley. Maybe before she even got started telling it good, that gentle white glow began like when you turn up a wick. Maybe he could even almost see his hand writing on into the space where the daughter, daughter, daughter never had quite showed. Because maybe that had been the lawyer's trouble and worry and concern all the time, that ever since she had made him promise he would never tell Bon who his father was, he had been waiting and wondering how to do it, since maybe he knew that if he were to tell Bon, Bon might believe it or he might not, but certainly he would go and tell his mother that the lawyer had told him, and then he, the lawyer, would be sunk. Not for any harm done, because there would be no harm, since this could not alter the situation, but for having crossed his paranoiac client. Maybe while he would sit in his office adding and subtracting the money and adding what they would get out of Sutphen, he was never worried about what Bon would do when he found out. He had probably a long time ago paid Bon that compliment of thinking that even if he was too dull or too indolent to suspect or find out about his father himself, he wasn't fool enough not to be able to take advantage of it once somebody showed him the proper move. Maybe if the thought had ever occurred to him that because of love or honor or anything else under heaven or jurisprudence either, Bon would not, would refuse to, he, the lawyer, would even have furnished proof that he no longer breathed. Maybe all the time it was this that racked him. How to get Bon where he would either have to find it out himself, or where somebody, the father or the mother, would have to tell him. So maybe she wasn't out of the office good, or at least as soon as he had had time to open the safe and look in the secret drawer and make sure that it was the University of Mississippi that Henry attended, before his hand was writing steady and even into the space where the daughter, daughter, daughter never had showed. And with the date here too, 1859, two children, say 1860, 20 years, increase 200% times intrinsic value yearly plus liquid assets plus credit earned. Approximate value 1860, 100,000. Query, bigamy threat, yes or no? Possible, no. Incest threat, credible, yes. And the hand going back before it put down the period, lining out the credible, writing in certain, underlining it. And he didn't care about that, too. He just said, all right. Because maybe he knew now that his mother didn't know and never would know what she wanted, and so he couldn't beat her. Maybe he had learned from the octoroon that you can't beat women anyhow, and that if you are wise or dislike trouble and uproar, you don't even try to. And he knew that all the lawyer wanted was just the money. And so, if he just didn't make the mistake of believing that he could beat all of it, if he just remembered to be quiet and be alert, he could beat some of it. So he said all right and let his mother pack the fine clothes and the fine linen into the bags and trunks, and maybe he lounged into the lawyer's office and watched from behind that something which could have been called smiling, while the lawyer made the elbow motion about getting his horses onto the steamboat and maybe buying him an extra special body servant and arranging about the money and all. Watching from behind the smiling while the lawyer did the heavy father even, talking about the scholarship, the culture, the Latin and the Greek that would equip and polish him for the position which he would hold in life, and how a man, to be sure, could get that anywhere, in his own library even, who had the will, but how there was something, some quality to culture which only the monastic, the cloistral monotony of a, say obscure and small, though high class, college. And he, neither of them said Bon, never at any time did there seem to be any confusion between them as to whom Shreve meant by he. Listening, courteous and quiet behind that expression which you were not supposed to see past. Asking at last, interrupting maybe, courteous and affable, nothing of irony, nothing of sarcasm. What did you say this college was? And now a good deal of elbow motion here, while the lawyer would shuffle through the papers to find the one from which he could read that name which he had been memorizing ever since he first talked to the mother. The University of Mississippi at... Where did you say? Oxford, Quentin said. It's about 40 miles from... Oxford. And then the papers could be still again, because he would be talking. About a small college, only 10 years old. About how there wouldn't be anything to distract him from his studies there, where, in a sense, wisdom herself would be a virgin, or at least not very second-hand, and how he would have a chance to observe another and a provincial section of the country in which his high destiny, Granted, the outcome of this war, which was without doubt imminent, the successful conclusion of which we all hoped for, had no doubt of. As the man he would be and the economic power he would represent when his mother passed on was rooted. And he listening behind that expression, saying, "Then you don't recommend the law as a vocation?" And now for just a moment the lawyer would stop, but not long, maybe not long enough or perceptible enough for you to call it pause. And he would be looking at Bond, too. "It hadn't occurred to me that the law might appeal to you." And Bond, "Neither did practicing with the rapier appeal to me while I was doing it, but I can recall at least one occasion in my life when I was glad I had." And then the lawyer, smooth and easy, "Then by all means let it be the law. Your mother will be pleased." "All right," he said. Not goodbye. He didn't care. Maybe not even goodbye to the octoroon, to those tears and lamentations and maybe even the clinging, the soft, despairing, magnolia-colored arms about his knees, and, say, 3.5 feet above that boneless steel gyves, that expression which was not smiling, but just something not to be seen through. Because you can't beat them. You just flee, and thank God you can flee, can escape from that massy, 5-foot-thick, maggot-cheesy solidarity which overlays the earth, in which men and women in couples are ranked and racked like ninepins. Thanks to whatever gods for that masculine, hipless, tapering peg which fits light and glib to move where the cartridge-chambered hips of women hold them fast. Not goodbye, all right. And one night he walked up the gangplank between the torches, and probably only the lawyer there to see him off, and this not for Godspeed, but to make sure that he actually took the boat. And the new extra nigger opening the bags in the stateroom, spreading the fine clothes, and the ladies already gathered in the saloon for supper, and the men in the bar preparing for it, but not he, he alone at the rail, with a cigar maybe, watching the city drift and wink and glitter and sink away, and then all motion cease, the boat suspended immobile and without progress from the stars themselves by the two ropes of spark-filled smoke streaming upward from the stacks. And who knows what thinking, what sober weighing and discarding, who had known for years that his mother was up to something even though he did not, probably believed he never would, know what, that the lawyer was up to something and though he knew that was just money, yet he knew that within his, the lawyer's, known masculine limitations, he, the lawyer, could be almost as dangerous as the unknown quantity which was his mother. And now this, school, college, and he 28 years old. And not only that, but this particular college, which he had never heard of, which 10 years ago did not even exist. And knowing, too, that it was the lawyer who had chosen it for him. What sober, what intent, what almost frowning why this college, this particular one above all others? Maybe leaning there in that solitude between panting smoke and engines, and almost touching the answer, aware of the jigsaw puzzle picture integers of it waiting, almost lurking, just beyond his reach, inextricable, jumbled, and unrecognizable, yet on the point of falling into pattern which would reveal to him at once, like a flash of light, the meaning of his whole life, past, the Haiti, the childhood, the lawyer, the woman who was his mother. And maybe the letter itself, right there under his feet, somewhere in the darkness beneath the deck on which he stood. The letter addressed not to Thomas Sutphen at Sutphen's Hundred, but to Henry Sutphen, Esquire, in residence at the University of Mississippi, near Oxford, Mississippi. And one day Henry showed it to him, and there was no gentle spreading glow, but a flash, a glare, who not only had no visible father, but had found himself to be, even in infancy, enclosed by an unsleeping cabal bent apparently on teaching him that he had never had, that his mother had emerged from a sojourn in limbo, from that state of blessed amnesia in which the weak senses can take refuge from the godless dark forces and powers which weak human flesh cannot stand, to wake pregnant, shrieking and screaming and thrashing, not against the ruthless agony of labor, but in protest against the outrage of her swelling loins, that he had been fathered on her not through that natural process, but had been blotted onto and out of her body by the old infernal immortal male principle of all unbridled terror and darkness, in which he stood looking at the innocent face of the youth almost 10 years his junior, while one part of him said, "My brow, my skull, my jaw, my hands," and the other said, "Wait, Wait, you can't know yet. You cannot know yet whether what you see is what you are looking at or what you are believing. Wait, wait. The letter which he... It was not Bonn he meant now, yet again Quentin seemed to comprehend without difficulty or effort whom he meant. Wrote, maybe as soon as he finished that last entry in the record, into the daughter, 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 while he thought, by all means he must not know now, must not be told before he can get there, and he and the daughter. Not remembering anything about young love from his own youth, and would not have believed it if he had, yet willing to use that too, as he would have used courage and pride, thinking not of any hushed wild importunate blood and light hands hungry for touching, but of the fact that this Oxford and this Sutphen's Hundred were only a day's ride apart, and Henry already established in the university, and so maybe for once in his life the lawyer even believed in God. My dear Mr. Sutphen, the undersigned name will not be known to you, nor are the writer's position and circumstances, for all their reflected worth and, I hope, value, so unobscure as to warrant the hope that he will ever see you in person, or you he. Worth reflected from and value rendered to two persons of birth and position, one of whom, a lady and widowed mother, resides in that seclusion befitting her condition in the city from which this letter is inscribed, the other of whom, a young gentleman, her son, will either be as you read this or will shortly thereafter be a petitioner before the same bar of knowledge and wisdom as yourself. It is in his behalf that I write. No, I will not say behalf. Certainly I shall not let his lady mother nor the young gentleman himself suspect that I used that term, even to one, sir, scion of the principal family of that county as it is your fortunate lot to be. Indeed, it were better for me if I had not written at all. But I do, I have. It is irrevocable now. If you discern aught in this letter which smacks of humility, take it as coming not from the mother and certainly not from the son, but from the pen of one whose humble position as legal adviser and man of business to the above-described lady and young gentleman, whose loyalty and gratitude toward one whose generosity has found him, I do not confess this, I proclaim it, in bread and meat and fire and shelter over a period long enough to have taught him gratitude and loyalty, even if he had not known them, has led him into an action whose means fall behind its intention for the reason that he is only what he is and professes himself to be, not what he would. So take this, sir, neither as the unwarranted insolence which an unsolicited communication from myself to you would be, not as a plea for sufferance on behalf of an unknown, but as an introduction, clumsy though it be, to one young gentleman whose position needs neither detailing nor recapitulation in the place where this letter is read, of another young gentleman whose position requires neither detailing nor recapitulation in the place where it was written. Not goodbye, all right, who had had so many fathers as to have neither love nor pride to receive or inflict, neither honor nor shame to share or bequeath, to whom one place was the same as another, like to a cat, cosmopolitan New Orleans or bucolic Mississippi, his own inherited and heritable Florentine lamps and gilded toilet seats and tufted mirrors, or a little jerkwater college not 10 years old, champagne in the octoroon's boudoir or whiskey on a harsh new table in a monk's cell and a country youth, a bucolic heir apparent who had probably never spent a dozen nights outside of his paternal house, unless perhaps to lie fully dressed beside a fire in the woods, listening to dogs running, until he came to school, whom he watched aping his clothing, carriage, speech, and all, and, the youth, completely unaware that he was doing it, who, the youth, over the bottle one night said, blurted, no, not blurted, it would be fumbling, groping, and he, the cosmopolite, 10 years the youth's senior almost, lounging in one of the silk robes, the like of which the youth had never seen before and believed that only women wore, watching the youth blush fiery red, yet still face him, still look him straight in the eye while he fumbled, groped, blurted with abrupt, complete irrelevance. If I had a brother, I wouldn't want him to be a younger brother. And he, ah, and the youth, no, I would want him to be older than me. And he, no son of a landed father wants an older brother. And the youth, yes, I do, looking straight at the other, the esoteric, the sybarite, standing, the youth, now erect, thin, because he was young, his face scarlet but his head high and his eyes steady. Yes, and I would want him to be just like you. And he, is that so? The whiskey's your side, drink or pass. And now, Shreve said, we're going to talk about love. But he didn't need to say that either, any more than he had needed to specify which he meant by he, since neither of them had been thinking about anything else. All that had gone before, just so much that had to be overpassed, and none else present to overpass it but them, as someone always has to rake the leaves up before you can have the bonfire. That was why it did not matter to either of them which one did the talking, since it was not the talking alone which did it, performed and accomplished the overpassing, but some happy marriage of speaking and hearing, wherein each before the demand, the requirement, forgave, condoned, and forgot the faulting of the other, faultings both in the creating of this shade whom they discussed, rather existed in, and in the hearing and sifting and discarding the false and conserving what seemed true, or fit the preconceived, in order to overpass to love, where there might be paradox and inconsistency, but nothing fault nor false. And now, love. He must have known all about her before he ever saw her, what she looked like, her private hours in that provincial women's world that even men of the family were not supposed to know a great deal about. He must have learned it without even having to ask a single question. Jesus, it must have kind of boiled out all over him. There must have been nights and nights while Henry was learning from him how to lounge about a bedroom in a gown and slippers, such as women wore, in a faint though unmistakable effluvium of scent, such as women used, smoking a cigar almost as a woman might smoke it, yet with all such an air of indolent and lethal assurance that only the most reckless man would have gratuitously drawn the comparison, and with no attempt to teach, train, play the mentor on his part. And then maybe yes. Maybe who could know what times he looked at Henry's face and thought, not there but for the intervening leaven of that blood which we do not have in common is my skull, my brow, sockets, shape, and angle of jaw, and chin, and some of my thinking behind it, and which he could see in my face in his turn if he but knew to look as I know. But there, just behind a little, obscured a little by that alien blood whose admixing was necessary in order that he exist, is the face of the man who shaped us both out of that blind, chancy darkness which we call the future. There, there, at any moment, second, I shall penetrate by something of will and intensity and dreadful need, and strip that alien leavening from it, and look not on my brother's face, whom I did not know I possessed, and hence never missed, but my father's, out of the shadow of whose absence my spirit's posthumeity has never escaped. At what moment, thinking, watching the eagerness which was without abjectness, the humility which surrendered no pride, the entire proffering of the spirit of which the unconscious aping of clothes and speech and mannerisms was but the shell, thinking, what cannot I do with this willing flesh and bone if I wish, this flesh and bone and spirit which stemmed from the same source that mine did, but which sprang in quiet peace and contentment and ran in steady, even though monotonous sunlight, where that which he bequeathed me sprang in hatred and outrage and unforgiving and ran in shadow. What could I not mould of this malleable and eager clay which that father himself could not? To what shape of what good there might, must be in that blood, and none handy to take and mould that portion of it in me until too late? Or what moments when he might have told himself that it was nonsense, it could not be true, that such coincidences only happen in books, thinking, the weariness, the fatalism, the incorrigible cat for solitude. That young clodhopper bastard, how shall I get rid of him? And then the voice, the other voice, you don't mean that. And he, no, but I do mean the clodhopper bastard. And the days, the afternoons, while they rode together, and Henry aping him here too, who was the better horseman, who maybe had nothing of what Bond would have called style, but who had done more of it, to whom a horse was as natural as walking, who would ride anything anywhere and at anything. While he must have watched himself being swamped and submerged in the bright unreal flood of Henry's speech, translated, the three of them, himself and Henry and the sister whom he had never seen and perhaps did not even have any curiosity to see, into a world like a fairy tale in which nothing else save them existed, riding beside Henry, listening, needing to ask no questions, to prompt to further speech in any manner that youth who did not even suspect that he and the man beside him might be brothers, who each time his breath crossed his vocal cords was saying, "From now on mine and my sister's house will be your house, and mine and my sister's lives your life." Wondering, Bon, or maybe not wondering at all, how if conditions were reversed and Henry was the stranger and he, Bon, the scion, and still knew what he suspected, if he would say the same. Then Bon, agreeing at last, saying at last, "All right, I'll come home with you for Christmas." Not to see the third inhabitant of Henry's fairy tale, not to see the sister, because he had not once thought of her. He had merely listened about her, but thinking, "So at last I shall see him whom it seems I was bred up never to expect to see, whom I had even learned to live without." Thinking maybe how he would walk into the house and see the man who had made him, and then he would know. There would be that flash, that instant of indisputable recognition between them, and he would know for sure and forever. Thinking maybe, "That's all I want. He need not even acknowledge me. I will let him understand just as quickly that he need not do that, that I do not expect that, will not be hurt by that, just as he will let me know that quickly that I am his son." Thinking maybe, maybe again with that expression you might call smiling, but which was not, which was just something that even just a clodhopper bastard was not intended to see beyond, "I am my mother's son, at least. I do not seem to know what I want either." Because he knew exactly what he wanted. It was just the saying of it, the physical touch, even though in secret, hidden. The living touch of that flesh warmed before he was born by the same blood which it had bequeathed him to warm his own flesh with. To be bequeathed by him in turn to run hot and loud in veins and limbs after that first flesh and then his own were dead. So the Christmas came, and he and Henry rode the 40 miles to Sutphen's Hundred, with Henry still talking, still keeping distended and light and iridescent with steady breathing that fairy balloon vacuum in which the three of them existed, lived, moved even maybe, in attitudes without flesh. Himself, and the friend, and the sister whom the friend had never seen and, though Henry did not know it, had not even thought about yet, but only listened about from behind the more urgent thinking, and Henry probably not even noticing that the nearer they came to home, the less Bond talked, had to say on any subject, and maybe even, and certainly Henry would not know this, listening less. And went into the house, and maybe somebody looking at him would have seen on his face an expression a good deal like the one, that proffering with humility yet with pride too of complete surrender, which he had used to see on Henry's face, and maybe he telling himself, "I not only don't know what it is I want, but apparently I am a good deal younger than I thought also." And saw face to face the man who might be his father. And nothing happened. No shock, no hot communicated flesh that speech would have been too slow even to impede. Nothing. And he spent 10 days there, not only the esoteric, the sybarite, the steel blade in the silken tessellated sheath which Henry had begun to ape at the university, but the object of art, the mold and mirror of form and fashion which Mrs. Sutphen, so your father said, accepted him as, and insisted, didn't your father say, that he be, and would have purchased him as, and paid for him, with Judith even, if there had been no other bidder among the four of them, or didn't your father say? And which he did remain to her until he disappeared, taking Henry with him, and she never saw him again, and war and trouble and grief and bad food filled her days, until maybe she didn't even remember after a while that she had ever forgot him. And the girl, the sister, the virgin, Jesus, who to know what she saw that afternoon when they rode up the drive? What prayer, what maiden meditative dream ridden up out of whatever fabulous land, not in harsh stove iron but the silken and tragic Lancelot nearing 30, 10 years older than she was and wearied, sated with what experiences and pleasures which Henry's letters must have created for her. And the day came to depart, and no sign yet. He and Henry rode away, and still no sign, no more sign at parting than when he had seen it first, in that face where he might, he would believe, have seen for himself the truth, and so would have needed no sign, if it hadn't been for the beard, no sign in the eyes which could see his face, because there was no beard to hide it, could have seen the truth if it were there, yet no flicker in them, and so he knew it was in his face because he knew that the other had seen it there just exactly as Henry was to know the next Christmas Eve in the library, that his father was not lying by the fact that the father said nothing, did nothing. Maybe he even thought, wondered, if perhaps that was not why the beard. If maybe the other had not hidden behind that beard against this very day. And if so, why? Why? Thinking, but why? Why? Since he wanted so little. Could have understood if the other had wanted the signal to be in secret. Would have been quick and glad to let it be in secret, even if he could not have understood why. Thinking in the middle of this, my God, I am young, young, and I didn't even know it. They didn't even tell me that I was young. Feeling that same despair and shame like when you have to watch your father fail in physical courage, thinking, it should have been me that failed. Me, I, not he who stemmed from that blood which we both bear before it could have become corrupt and tainted by whatever it was in mothers that he could not brook. Wait, Shreve cried, though Quentin had not spoken. It had been merely some quality, some gathering of Quentin's still laxed and hunched figure which presaged speech. Because Shreve said, wait, wait, before Quentin could have begun to speak. Because he hadn't even looked at her. Oh, he had seen her all right. He had had plenty of opportunity for that. He could not have helped but that because Mrs. Sutphen would have seen to it. 10 days of that kind of planned and arranged and executed privacies, like the campaigns of dead generals in the textbooks, in libraries and parlors, and drives in the buggy in the afternoons. All planned 3 months ago when Mrs. Sutphen read Henry's first letter with Bond's name in it, until maybe even Judith, too, began to feel like the other one to a pair of goldfish. And him even talking to her, too, or what talking he could have found to do to a country girl who probably never saw a man young or old before who sooner or later didn't smell like manure. Talking to her about like he would talk to the old dame on the gold chairs in the parlor, except that in the one case he would have to make all the conversation, and in the other he would not even be able to make his own escape, but would have to wait for Henry to come and get him. And maybe he had even thought about her by that time, maybe at the times when he would be telling himself, it can't be so. He could not look at me like this every day and make no sign if it were so. He would even tell himself she would be easy. Like when you have left the champagne on the supper table and are walking toward the whiskey on the sideboard, and you happen to pass a cup of lemon sherbet on a tray, and you look at the sherbet and tell yourself, that would be easy too, only who wants it? Does that suit you? But it's not love, Quentin said. Because why not? Because listen. Wasn't it the old dame, the Aunt Rosa, told you about how there are some things that just have to be whether they are or not? Have to be a damn sight more than some other things that maybe are, and it don't matter a damn whether they are or not. That was it. He just didn't have time yet. Jesus, he must have known it would be. Like that lawyer thought, he wasn't a fool. The trouble was, he wasn't the kind of not fool the lawyer thought he would be. He must have known it was going to happen. It would be like you passed that sherbet, and maybe you knew you would even reach the sideboard and the whiskey, yet you knew that tomorrow morning you would want that sherbet. Then you reached the whiskey and you knew you wanted that sherbet now. Maybe you didn't even go to the sideboard. Maybe you even looked back at that champagne on the supper table among the dirty Haviland and the crumpled damask. And all of a sudden you knew you didn't want to go back there even. It would be no question of choosing, having to choose, between the champagne or whiskey and the sherbet. But all of a sudden, it would be spring then, in that country where he had never spent a spring before, and you said North Mississippi is a little harder country than Louisiana, with dogwood and violets and the early scentless flowers, but the earth and the nights still a little cold, and the hard, tight, sticky buds like young girls' nipples on alder and Judas trees and beech and maple, and even something young in the cedars like he never saw before. You find that you don't want anything but that sherbet, and that you haven't been wanting anything else but that, and you've been wanting that pretty hard for some time, besides knowing that that sherbet is there for you to take. Not just for anybody to take, but for you to take, knowing just from looking at that cup that it would be like a flower that, if any other hand reached for it, it would have thorns on it, but not for your hand. And him not used to that since all the other cups that had been willing and easy for him to take up hadn't contained sherbet but champagne, or at least kitchen wine. And more than that, There was the knowing what he suspected might be so, or not knowing if it was so or not. And who to say if it wasn't maybe the possibility of incest? Because who, without a sister, I don't know about the others, has been in love and not discovered the vain evanescence of the fleshly encounter? Who has not had to realize that when the brief is all done, you must retreat from both love and pleasure, gather up your own rubbish and refuse, the hats and pants and shoes which you drag through the world, and retreat, since the gods condone and practice these, and the dreamy immeasurable coupling which floats oblivious above the trammeling and harried instant. The was not is was is a perquisite only of balloony and weightless elephants and whales. But maybe if there were sin too, maybe you would not be permitted to escape, uncouple, return. Ain't that right? He ceased. He could have been interrupted easily now. Quentin could have spoken now, but Quentin did not. He just sat as before, his hands in his trousers pockets, his shoulders hugged inward and hunched, his face lowered, and he looked somehow curiously smaller than he actually was because of his actual height and spareness. That quality of delicacy about the bones, articulation, which even at 20 still had something about it, some last echo about it of adolescence. That is, as compared with the cherubic burliness of the other who faced him, who looked younger, whose very superiority in bulk and displacement made him look even younger, as a plump boy of 12 who outweighs the other by 20 or 30 pounds still looks younger than the boy of 14, who had that plumpness once and lost it, sold it, whether with his consent or not, for that state of virginity which is neither boys nor girls. "I don't know," Quentin said. "All right," Shreve said. "Maybe I don't either. Only, Jesus, some day you are bound to fall in love. They just wouldn't beat you that way. It would be like if God had got Jesus born and saw that he had the carpenter tools and then never gave him anything to build with them. Don't you believe that?" "I don't know," Quentin said. He did not move. Shreve looked at him. Even while they were not talking, their breaths in the tomb-like air vaporized gently and quietly. The chimes for midnight would have rung some time ago now. "You mean it don't matter to you?" Quentin did not answer. "That's right, don't say it, because I would know you are lying." "All right, then, listen. Because he never had to worry about the love, because that would take care of itself. Maybe he knew there was a fate, a doom on him, like what the old Aunt Rosa told you about some things that just have to be, whether they are or not, just to balance the books. Write paid on the old sheet so that whoever keeps them can take it out of the ledger and burn it, get rid of it. Maybe he knew then that whatever the old man had done, whether he meant well or ill by it, it wasn't going to be the old man who would have to pay the check. And now that the old man was bankrupt with the incompetence of age, who should do the paying if not his sons, his get? Because wasn't it done that way in the old days? The old Abraham, full of years and weak and incapable now of further harm, caught at last, and the captains and the collectors saying, 'Old man, we don't want you.' And Abraham would say, 'Praise the Lord, I have raised about me sons to bear the burden of mine iniquities and persecutions. Yea, perhaps even to restore my flocks and herds from the hand of the ravisher, that I might rest mine eyes upon my goods and chattels, upon the generations of them and of my descendants increased an hundredfold as my soul goeth out from me.'" He knew all the time that the love would take care of itself. Maybe that was why he didn't have to think about her during those 3 months between that September and that Christmas, while Henry talked about her to him, saying every time he breathed, "Hers and my lives are to exist within and upon yours." Did not need to waste any time over the love after it happened, backfired on him. Why he never bothered to write her any letters, except that last one, which she would want to save. Why he never actually proposed to her and gave her a ring for Mrs. Sutphen to show around. Because the fate was on her, too. The same old Abraham, who was so old and weak now, nobody would want him in the flesh on any debt. Maybe he didn't even have to wait for that Christmas to see her to know this. Maybe that's what it was that came out of the 3 months of Henry's talking that he heard without listening to. "I am not hearing about a young girl, a virgin. I am hearing about a narrow, delicate, fenced virgin field, already furrowed and bedded, so that all I shall need to do is drop the seeds in, caress it smooth again. Saw her that Christmas, and knew it for certain, and then forgot it, went back to school and did not even remember that he had forgotten it, because he did not have time then. Maybe it was just one day in that spring you told about when he stopped and said, right quiet, "All right, I want to go to bed with who might be my sister, all right." And then forgot that too, because he didn't have time. That is, he didn't have anything else but time, because he had to wait. But not for her. That was all fixed. It was the other. Maybe he thought it would be in the mailbag each time the nigger rode over from Sutpen's Hundred, and Henry, believing it was the letter from her that he was waiting for, when what he was thinking was, maybe he will write it then. He would just have to write, "I am your father, burn this, and I would do it." Or if not that, a sheet of scrap paper with the one word Charles in his hand, and I would know what he meant, and he would not even have to ask me to burn it. Or a lock of his hair, or a paring from his fingernail, and I would know them, because I believe now that I have known what his hair and his fingernails would look like all my life, could choose that lock and that paring out of 1,000. And it did not come, and his letter went to her every 2 weeks, and hers came back to him, and maybe he thought, if one of mine to her should come back to me unopened, then that would be a sign. And that didn't happen. And then Henry began to talk about his stopping at Sutpen's Hundred for a day or so on his way home, and he said all right to it, said, it will be Henry who will get the letter saying it is inconvenient for me to come at that time. So apparently he does not intend to acknowledge me as his son, but at least I shall have forced him to admit that I am. And that one did not come either, and the date was set, and the family at Sutpen's Hundred notified of it, and that letter did not come either, and he thought, it will be then. I wronged him. Maybe this is what he has been waiting for. And maybe his heart sprang then. Maybe he said, yes, yes, I will renounce her. I will renounce love and all. That will be cheap, cheap. Even though he say to me, never look upon my face again, take my love and my acknowledgement in secret and go, I will do that. I will not even demand to know of him what it was my mother did that justified his action toward her and me. So the day came, and he and Henry rode the 40 miles again, into the gates and up the drive to the house. He knew what would be there. The woman whom he had seen once and seen through, the girl whom he had seen through without even having to see once, the man whom he had seen daily, watched out of his fearful intensity of need and had never penetrated, the mother who had taken Henry aside before they had been 6 hours in the house on that Christmas visit and informed him of the engagement almost before the fiancé had had time to associate the daughter's name with the daughter's face. So that probably before they even reached school again, and without his being aware that he had done so, Henry had already told Bonn what was in his mother's mind, who had already told Bonn what was in his. So that maybe before they even started on Bonn's second visit, it would be June now, and what would it be in North Mississippi? What was it you said? The magnolias in bloom and the mockingbirds. And in 50 years more, after they had gone and fought it and lost it and come back home, the Decoration Day and the veterans in the neat brushed hand-ironed gray and the spurious bronze medals that never meant anything to begin with, and the chosen young girls in white dresses bound at the waist with crimson sashes, and the band would play Dixie, and all the old doddering men would yell that you would not have thought would have had wind enough to get there, walk downtown to sit on the rostrum even. It would be June now, with the magnolias and mockingbirds in the moonlight and the curtains blowing in the June air of commencement, and the music, fiddles and triangles, inside among the swirling and dipping hoops. And Henry would be a little tight, that should have been saying, I demand to know your intentions toward my sister, but wasn't saying it. Instead, maybe blushing again even in the moonlight, but standing straight and blushing because when you are proud enough to be humble, you don't have to cringe. Who every time he breathed over his vocal cords, he was saying, we belong to you, do as you will with us. Saying, I used to think that I would hate the man that I would have to look at every day and whose every move and action and speech would say to me, I have seen and touched parts of your sister's body that you will never see and touch. And now I know that I shall hate him, and that's why I want that man to be you. Knowing that Bonn would know what he meant, was trying to say, tell him, thinking, telling himself, Henry, not just because he is older than I am and has known more than I shall ever know and has remembered more of it, but because of my own free will, and whether I knew it at the time or not does not matter, I gave my life and Judith's both to him.